south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. All right, here's a little email that says it all. It's from Mr. CB. He says, Johnny, guess what? Got in contact with the dentist you recommend in Guatemala City. He's going to do a bridge for me for $800 that would have cost $5,500 in Kansas. Well, Mr. CB, as the old wizard would say, Dorothy, you're not in Kansas anymore, or Cleveland for that matter. We're not talking fantasy land here. $800 for a bridge that would cost $5,500 in Kansas. I know, you skeptics are thinking he must be working on some kind of backwoods garage. Dogs barking, frijoles cooking, and chickens running around in the waiting room pooping on the floor. Go ahead, think that. That's because you haven't had any boots on the ground. This particular dentist, the one I always recommend if you're around Guatemala City, he's located in a brand new high-rise office tower with fantastic security. In fact, if you ask me, it's security overkill. Not only that, he has all the most modern equipment first-world dentists have. And wouldn't you know it, he's not just a dentist. He's an oral surgeon trained in the U.S. Did I mention he's 100% bilingual? Well, he'd have to be, right, if he went to school up in the States. So what's he doing in Guatemala if he got his degree from up in the States? Well, they asked him to stay on in the States as an oral surgeon. But he's a family guy, brother, sisters, mother, wife in Guatemala. And he always told me, for me, the pace of life in the States was way too hectic. You have to laugh if you think he's in it for the money. And really, how could he be in it for the money when he's charging an eighth what they charge up in the States? Oh, and did I tell you, he's almost never in the office on Friday? First thought, golfing or hanging at the club with the professional boys, right? Wrong. This guy, being a U.S.-trained oral surgeon, donates one day a week doing operations on people who can't afford the treatment, people with terrible facial and dental conditions who must go to the medieval public free hospitals to get any kind of care at all. He's doing cleft palates on little kids, jaw resections, and all kinds of other oral surgery for free. So he donates one day a week just because he's a caring, great guy. In fact, he showed me a photo album and an online site of hundreds of people he'd worked on. Come on, where do you find guys like that? Well, it took me about 15 years to find him. And sure, it's not to say they're all like that. There are various levels of medical and dental care, and you got to know which is which, or you could end up in the soup. Like a lady friend of mine from Canada who went to Costa Rica to get some really cheap bridge work done. Didn't work out for her. And when she got back to Canada, she found it all had to be redone. It was a terrible job. So then, what if you need dental work and you're not in Guatemala? How do you find a guy like that? I mean, there's hundreds of dentists in every medium and large city in Latin America. Same thing with medical doctors and specialists. Well, why do you think I wrote a 100-page report called Healthcare in Latin America, How to Get First World Treatment at Third World Prices? I bet most of you listeners are thinking about a plan B or you're putting one together right now. And wherever your final destination in Latin America is going to be, you're going to need to find your own dentist, physician, specialist, hospitals, clinics, and insurance plans. You want to figure some of that stuff out once you land, even before you land. Because, you know, if you're in a foreign country, if you get sick or a tooth breaks, you don't want to work yourself into a panic trying to find someone at the very last minute. But unfortunately, that happens a lot, especially with new green expats. They just don't give it much thought. But the question is, how do you scope it out? Find out ahead of time. Of course, if you come to my next Expat Insider Seminar, we'll hook you up with some of these guys face to face. You know, at the seminar, we actually spend a whole day sussing out insurance plans, doctors, hospitals, clinics, and of course, we do boots on the ground in one of the nicest first world hospitals you'll ever see. And a doctor friend of mine who's 100% bilingual, a trauma specialist for that hospital, walks us through and answers all your questions. Oh, and he does house calls too. They all do. How much? $25 to $35. That's what they charge without insurance. Oh, and speaking of my next Expat Insider Seminar, I've been getting some inquiries about that. It looks like it's going to be right after the 4th of July, starting actually on the 5th of July, because almost everyone gets that Friday off, with 4th of July this year falling on a Thursday. That should make it all that much easier for people who work and need to take some time off, because you'll already have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off. And with the week-long seminar starting on a Friday, you're halfway there with 3 days already. So it looks like the seminar will start on the 5th of July. That's a Friday. So you'll be able to do your 4th of July thing with your family and friends, if that's what you do. You could fly in on the 5th because the seminar really doesn't get started till the evening of the 5th. That's when we'll have our meet and greet and our first get-together. So plan on coming to the seminar and drinking from the fire hose. Remember, it's my promise that you'll get a 3 to 5 year head start on living in Latin America by coming to my week-long seminar. Though some people say the best thing about it is all those face-to-face connections and lifelong friends you're going to make. So just shoot me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll put you on my early bird discount waiting list so you'll get the info and updates before everyone else. However, no matter how far along you are on your plan B, even if you're just getting started, you have to start thinking about dentists, physicians, hospitals, clinics, and healthcare insurance, which is incredibly cheap down here. Now, short of coming to the seminar this July, the best primer you can get on the subject is my 100-page Latin American healthcare report. To check it out, just go to theexpatfiles.com/healthcare. Theexpatfiles, all one word, .com/healthcare. All right, moving on. You know, you longtime listeners who've been listening more than 5 years now, I think we're on the air about 9 years, right? You might remember that story I told regarding getting your propane tanks filled and exchanged in Latin America, and how the suppliers will always short you a bit. They'll always short you. Usually not by much, but it all adds up, doesn't it? And you wonder, how do these companies get away with it? Especially when you see their ads in newspapers, online and stuff, even on TV, saying, exact weight guaranteed. Well, that's a load of BS. They get away with it, and they've been getting away with it for the last 50 years or so, ever since propane tanks have been in existence down here, because no one ever weighs the tanks when they receive them. But on occasion, Johnny Mueller does, and every time he has, he's caught him red-handed. Man, you should have seen the look on the face of the little guy that was delivering those things when I first grabbed a big tank and rolled it over on my scale. And you know, just a simple $15 bathroom scale is all you need. So you put a 100-pound tank on that bathroom scale and it reads, let's say, 126 pounds. Of course, every empty tank itself has its own weight and that's stamped right on it. So again, if you've got a 100-pound tank on a scale and it says 126 pounds and it's stamped 26 pounds on the tank, meaning when it's empty, it's 26 pounds, that means you ain't been had. You ain't been swindled out of any propane gas. But, you know, over the years, I've weighed my tanks dozens of times, and they always come out at around 94, 96, 97, always short by a couple of percentage points, up to 6, even 7% short. Naturally, at first, I was pissed off being a gringo who expects to get what he pays for. I'd phone up the company, bitch at him in my bad Spanish. They'd be kind of shocked and put me on hold for long periods of time. Lots of lo siento, sorry about that. But never, ever did it change a thing. They kept on coming up short. In fact, many years ago when I first thought to weigh the tanks, just out of curiosity and I noticed what was going on and called them on it, after a while I'd pestered them so much, when I'd call for a refill, they just quit coming. Sure enough, they'd put me on the feces list. I was an irate gringo customer they didn't want to have to deal with anymore. But luckily, no matter where you are in Latin America, there's always a couple competing propane gas delivery services, so just call a competitor and they'll be glad to deliver their underfilled tanks to you. So I learned a long time ago, you can't win in the propane gas game. You're stuck, you're going to get shorted, and though it'll piss you off, you're better off just sucking it up. But note, no matter how much it pisses you off, you should never cut yourself off from having a few propane tanks around the house. It's a lifesaver. You will need it if you're entertaining thoughts of going off the grid or even partially off the grid. I suggest you always have 2 100-pound tanks strapped with a chain to a concrete wall in your garage or outside your house. And those 200-pound tanks, when filled with their 94 pounds, will easily provide enough gas for a family of four to run their stove and their gas dryer for a year. Even 2 years if you're conservation-minded and know a few tricks. Now, you heard me say gas stove and gas dryer. Well, if you have a cleaning lady, and even if you don't, if you dry your clothes on a clothesline, then you'll only be using that propane for your stove. Then those two 100-pound tanks of yours, 96-pound tanks, whatever, will last a family of four probably 3 or 4 years. Talk about big-time prepping without even thinking about it. By the way, you first have to buy those tanks, and empties cost around $100 a piece, but they're yours, and you keep on trading them with the propane company as they run out. Oh, and though you should know, not too many people here in Latin America actually have hot running water, but us gringos and expats expect it, so we always do. And normally, it's one of those on-demand electric units that sits under your counter. But man, when they kick in, they use a ton of juice. But they're cheap. Even the good ones are cheap. Around $150 or so. And that's why I'd say around 80% of the people who do have hot water in their house use those things. But note, big note here, I'm not talking about those electric suicide shower heads. Those things are really cheap, only around $20. They exclusively heat up the water in your shower. In fact, they are the shower head. Yes, they do work, but you're never going to get used to the fact that there are heavy electric wires hanging from your shower head. As for me, being an electrical engineer in a past life, those things scare me. To tell you the truth, I don't recommend them because occasionally they do give you shocks, and why you just never read about them electrocuting people, I'll never know. However, if when you first come down to Latin America, you decide to rent in a middle-class neighborhood, middle-class Latin style, that would be to us lower middle class, it's almost a guarantee your shower's going to have one of those. However, if you're in a decent hotel or rent in an upper middle class neighborhood, that would be solid middle class in the States, you're probably going to have whole house hot water, which means no suicide shower head. Now, when you talk about upper middle class and wealthy Latin Americans, they usually have a propane gas whole house hot water heater. They're double or triple the price of an on-demand electric one. But using propane gas are a hell of a lot cheaper to run. I used to have one of those myself for a long, long time. Yep, they're efficient all right, but they still use a lot of gas when they're on. So if you have a gas stove, which I highly recommend, a gas dryer, which I recommend too, even if you hang your clothes outside, a gas dryer really comes in handy in the rainy season. Anyway, if you have a gas stove, a gas dryer, and gas whole house hot water heat, if you have two full 100-pound tanks of gas at home, again, you'll get shorted, but you knew that already. Don't let that piss you off, or you might as well stay in Cleveland. Anyway, if you're running those three gas appliances at home, 200-pound tanks will probably last you 6 months. Turns out that gas hot water heater will be using more gas than the other two appliances, your stove and dryer combined. That's why a couple of years back I switched to a solar hot water heater, and that cut my propane gas usage in less than half. But you know, I still have that gas hot water heater connected in line in case I have to use it. Maybe 4 or 5 days out of the year, I do. Because there can be a few days in a row during the rainy season when there's almost no sun at all clouds and rain, so your solar water heater can't heat up. Oh, and that rooftop solar hot water heater costs around $1,000 installed. And that thing takes care of 95% or more of my hot water needs. So if you think about it, a big step to being 100% self-sufficient and off the grid is to get propane gas tanks, two 100-pounders, that's my recommendation, and you should think about dropping a grand and getting the largest solar hot water heater that you can. You'll find here in Latin America, generally, they come in two or three sizes. The smaller one having a 100-liter storage tank, that's about 25 gallons, and I wouldn't recommend that unit. I'd recommend a bigger one. They've got a 200-liter, which is 50 gallon, and a 300-liter, which is almost 80 gallons. I'd say go for the 300 liters. But even so, the more people you have in the house, the more you have to plan a bit around when the water is going to be at its hottest. For example, it's not a very good idea for people in the house to take a shower in the evening, because then in the morning, when you wake up, there won't be any hot water for a morning shower, obviously because at night there's no sun to heat it back up. So you have to experiment a little, takes a little planning. Meanwhile, 70, even 80% of Latin American households don't even have hot water. So by all means, get a solar hot water heater. It's a gift that keeps on giving. Oh, and here's something I'm sure you didn't know. Nearly all the solar hot water units in Latin America come from China. Easy guess, right? But here's what you didn't know. Every one of those solar hot water heater rooftop setups has an electric heater element in it. I'm sure you've seen those solar hot water heater setups in the U.S., in the southern U.S. I say the southern U.S. because up in the northern climes where it freezes solid, they have much more complicated different kinds of solar hot water heaters because they have to use antifreeze and special circuits and heat exchangers, etc., and can cost over $5,000. But in the southern U.S. states, they can get away with using the simple ones, just like the ones used throughout Latin America. Though, as mentioned, they have a heating element in them too, just in case there are some cold nights and you get some freezing. They're set up so the heating element kicks in and maintains a minimum temperature in the water. Problem is, the units in Latin America don't need that heating element, but they've got them installed. So, depending where you set the temperature for that thing on the little computer panel that comes with the unit, that heating element in your unit could inadvertently turn on every night. And that element uses a pretty good amount of electricity when it kicks in. My advice, just disconnect the thing completely. Then you'll never have that problem. Now, you're probably thinking in most of Latin America, it's pretty damn hot. Even at night, it probably doesn't go below 50 degrees. Aha, that's true. But I noticed that my electric resistance unit inside my solar hot water heater was set up to kick in at 60 degrees. That seemed a bit nuts. So, there would be some nights that it would kick in, which is why I disconnected it. And you know, that's something I think almost no one I know here in Latin America who owns one of those units has any idea about. So I'm thinking nearly everyone who's got a rooftop unit like that is paying for some electricity needlessly. So, a little heads up on that if you decide to get a solar hot water heater, which is highly recommended. Now, from there, of course, the next step is to go completely off the grid electrically, too. I think now, and I've done it myself, if you live in the Altiplano, you have skylights in your house and you don't have any air conditioning or heating expenses, and you won't if you're in the Altiplano, that would be from 4,000 to maybe 6,000 feet above sea level, you'll be able to go completely solar with your electrical needs, that's solar panels, batteries, regulator, and all, for around 5 to maybe 8,000 bucks. Then you can be the kind of low-key prepper, sort of a prepper light, but totally covered for any emergency situation, that prepper fanatics in the States with their basements totally stocked can only dream about. And if you've got any kind of land at all, even a small garden, you'll be able to grow all kinds of things. Remember, you've got four growing seasons. You know, if you go completely solar, you'll find the things that draw the most power are your refrigerator, your lights at night, and your washing machine motor. But these days, notice if you buy a refrigerator, they're big-time energy misers. And as for your lights, it's a must that you switch over to those really efficient LED lights. They're streamlined, small, they look nice, unlike those terribly ugly and dangerously polluting fluorescent bulbs. Those things are filled with mercury gas, and so you have to be really careful how you dispose of those things. Besides the fact they give off that institutional sort of hospital/prison glare. Neither elegant nor classy, just kind of harsh looking. Though unfortunately, almost every middle class, even upper middle class Latin American house you walk into has a ton of those ugly things. You know what always messes with my mind? I walk into a really nice Latin American upper middle class house. Real 100% hardwood doors and trim, 100% granite and marble countertops too. The real solid thick stuff, better than Corian. Some have fantastic terracotta roofs and Spanish tile floors. Pure class, well, you'd think. Yet you walk into one of those rooms and see those terribly ugly fluorescent bulbs everywhere. And most of the time, they're not even covered with a fixture. They're just the bare ugly bulbs sticking out of the socket. Details, details. Oh, and speaking of bare bulbs, here's a hotel hack I've been using for a long, long time. Every time I travel, and I've been doing a lot of that lately, I carry a high-powered LED bulb in my luggage. Because, you know, these days, unless you're staying at a 4- or 5-star hotel, whatever difference there is there. Turns out almost all 2- and 3-star hotels, and of course all the hostels and backpacker joints, are lit like dungeons. Use the smallest wattage bulbs they can buy because, hey, electricity ain't cheap in Latin America. It's one of the only things that's not cheap. Then at night, when you're sitting in your room and maybe you want to read something like a newspaper or a book, something that's not on your iPhone, computer, or other device, it's really annoying when you just don't have enough light. So I bring one or two of my own high-wattage LED bulbs. When I say high-wattage, when you're talking about LED bulbs, 15 watts is big time. Plus, unlike those fluorescent bulbs, which are really fragile, LED bulbs are practically indestructible. Generally, they've got a heavy-duty plastic outer coating on the bulb instead of that thin, very breakable glass you find on those curly-Q fluorescent bulbs. Man, I hate those things. What a crap invention. So if you're traveling and not staying in a $150 or $200 a night four-star hotel, my recommendation is you carry a high-wattage LED bulb or two. You won't regret it, but do remember to bring them with you when you leave. Or the next guy in your room will reap the benefit of your little hack. Who knows, if you're a generous and nice guy and leave it there, maybe the next guy will pay it forward. But you know, speaking of four, even five-star hotels, if there's a difference, what about six-star and seven-star hotels? I guess they're coming, right? Especially when robots start infiltrating the hospitality business full-time, and that's coming soon, too. Anyway, I've found even in four-star hotels that bathroom lighting can be quite dim and crappy. So even if you pay the big bucks for a multiple-star hotel, there's no guarantee when you stumble in half asleep at 2 in the morning that you won't be peeing on the floor. Hey, don't say you've never been there. At 2 in the morning, how's your aim? Of course, I'm talking about guys here because ladies never miss, right? All right, speaking of refrigeration, I think there's something we need to talk about. I'll start by reading a part of this email. It comes from part-time expat Matt, who spends a lot of time in Mexico. He says, Johnny, here's a bit of a funny story that happened to me and reminded me of a show you did a long time ago when you were talking about misweighing propane tanks. Ah, again with the propane tanks. He says, I went to the Mega Market supermarket to buy shrimp one day, and there were no problems. I went back the next day to get more, and this time the package of the shrimp had an enormous amount of water in it. Obviously, the shrimp packages had thawed out overnight. So me, being a gringo, wanting to put things right, I had the worker drain the water from a package and reweigh it for me. He did it, reweighed it, and put on a new price sticker reflecting the real weight. I know this will sound unbelievable, Johnny, but there was actually 2 times as much water weight in the package as there were shrimp. But I ended up getting it for a third of the cost. Ha ha! Made me feel good. How's that for a clever use of the gringo advantage? All right, Matt, good story. But, and a big retard assian butt here, that clever use of the gringo advantage could have gotten you in big trouble, man. And I don't mean with the management either. I'm talking about a problem I see all the time in supermarkets, especially mom-and-pop supermarkets that aren't a big chain. Unfortunately, when it comes to frozen stuff, there's a tremendous amount of thawing and refreezing going on, and that, as far as bacterial counts, is not a good thing. Now, of course, if you buy a lot of frozen foods, there are telltale signs when that's happening. You know, a lot of snow buildup in the package, or big, solid chunks of ice that seem to be stuck to the corners inside the packages. The thing is, you never know, and that's why I almost never buy frozen things in Latin America. Even if I'm standing there watching them unloading that stuff from a frozen food delivery truck. Of course, we're in the tropics and subtropics here. And you know, 100% of the frozen items that are delivered to grocery stores and mom-and-pop outlets are coming by truck, and mostly by regular trucks, not refrigerated trucks. So you never really know if the contents of a package has thawed and been refrozen or how many times that's happened. Even once is too much, especially when it comes to chicken or fish. And you know, after being down here in Latin America so long and seeing how food is handled and mishandled, especially in regard to those little mom-and-pop street carts, not to mention the occasional power outages, I personally believe the number one cause of Montezuma's revenge is eating street food, and then number two, eating food that was previously thawed and then refrozen and thawed and refrozen before it ever got to your plate. Of course, you know, anything with a high bacterial count that's been thoroughly cooked is not going to be a problem. But many times I've seen for myself when I ordered fish or chicken in a restaurant that it hasn't been cooked all the way through. I've sent partially cooked food back to the kitchen dozens of times. But a lot of people just don't. Anyway, you should give a little thought to that, and I think it's a bigger problem than people realize. Because, you know, Montezuma's revenge is not a rite of passage. You just have to keep your eyes open and take a few precautions, and you never have to get it. Yet, I talk to gringos and expats who've been down here quite a while who still have the occasional date with the porcelain goddess. Of course, too much partying, tequila, local beer, etc. will take its toll. But I'm talking about foodborne illness now. It doesn't have to be that way. I personally have not had an attack of Montezuma's Revenge for probably 5 or 10 years now. I can't even remember it's been so long. Though I've talked to many seasoned backpackers who should know better, but they still seem to get the squirts on a regular basis. And they always hit me with that old cliche, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And my reply, as they turn ashen pale and head for the bathroom, how's that working for you? So anyway, in Matt's email, he seems to be proud of the fact that they were able to drain the water and he got his shrimp at a third of the price. But man, to me, that's kind of a hollow victory. On that note, here's a couple of eating tips that have served me well. Number one, I don't eat sushi, rare meat, or ceviche. You know, that's raw shrimp and seafood. They put it in lemon overnight, or for some hours it's supposed to kill all the bacteria. Well, it does, in theory. But there's no guarantee. You never know. It could be sitting out on the counter a long time. Number two, no salads unless I make them myself. Number three, no ice cubes unless I've made them myself. Number four, when eating out, always drink out of a bottle, never from a glass. Number five, when you're out, skip things like potato salad or bean salad when they're made with mayonnaise. Mayonesa. Vinegar and oil, A-OK, but mayonesa, no. And also, skip anything that's been sitting on a table for some hours and has been in direct sunlight. Of course, if flies have been landing on it, don't eat it. Though you'll find that Latinos generally just shoo them away and go at it anyway. Not me. If flies are landing, I'm not eating. Oh, and there's something else I always do, though I try to do it stealthily, or it could raise some eyebrows. I take my silverware and I wipe it down good and hard with a clean napkin or servietta. Because Latinos aren't concerned too much about which parts they touch as they place silverware in and out of drawers and put it on tables. And finally, on a completely different topic, the other day I was at a Costco and I saw right in front of the door the pregnant lady courtesy parking spot. How nice. Marked off with a cute little stork. And I thought to myself, if today I happened to identify as a pregnant transvestite, what would I do? I guess I'd legally be able to use it if I was at a Costco up where you live. But here, at a Costco in Latin America, if a security guard happened to be standing right there, I'd get a boot up my ass. And that's reason 2,426. You really got to get that plan B going and get the hell out of Dodge. You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!